So Nathan, we went like skating earlier today at the Bro Bowl, but we were talking about like our first jobs and shit, and like I was thinking about like working at in retail again, and retail is truly a nightmare. Like I think back on it, like truly a nightmare. And it's like it's so funny to me, like when I was like a 14-year-old, like fucking
Gafer.
yeah, gafer, no, a 14-year-old, like just like metalhead, and like the only place at the time you could get like band t-shirts that wasn't a concert was like Hot Topic. And I always be like, wow, this would be such a great place to work. And then like I actually started working there, like when I was,
I didn't know that.
yeah, I worked there when I was 22, like part time, because I was a stock boy folding fucking panties and bras at Victoria's Secret in like Roy G. Biv or order or whatever. But I would leave there and then walk across the mall to the Hot Topic and pick up a shift there. And I just remember how insane that job was. First of all, they had us like, because all retail now is just in decline. So the huge thing that they're like, they've been put, and they've been doing this for years, is they push credit cards, because you know they have like 25% interest, and the stores and the banks get a cut of that.
Free
and all
money
that
for
stuff.
them.
Right, but Hot Topic has a credit card, and it's like, what do people buy there other than like little like
butt plugs.
Sailor Moon trinkets and like Sailor Moon butt plugs and like that's
a lot of band shirts
and band shirts. But even band shirt sales have been on the decline forever, mainly because the only bands they sell shirts of now suck.
Yeah, they're all like dadcore bands.
Yeah,
that don't even play shows.
All the shirts that actually sell are like throwbacks, like when they'll have like.
Like Beatles or Iron Maiden, or
yeah, that's
that one fucking Nirvana shirt.
Yeah, or you know, but even when they have like
Sublime,
no, even when they have throwbacks of like when they put in like black metal t-shirts, like they'll have that like classic Dark Throne t-shirt of their first album, or they'll do like, you know, like bands that you wouldn't expect them to have t-shirts of, Emperor, Cannibal Corpse, Obituary, all of that stuff sells because it's like people are like, holy shit, didn't expect to find that. That's a classic. Or it's like some 90s dad, you know, like who is in there with his kid who listens to like 21 Pilots and he wants to kill himself and he sees like a metal band t-shirt that he likes. But anyway, I'm sidetracking. But yeah, it just like reminded me of how awful it was to work there, because I'd have to like, you know, they're on your ass about selling credit cards. And so you're like, hey, you know, mom with 16-year-old child who spends like $200 here once a year, like, please open this credit card. And like sometimes they will because of the like perks or whatever they want. But like, so I mean, that's like pretty awful. And they're like, they make you be pretty ruthless about that. But oh my God, like you always think when you're younger, like, man, this would be a cool place to work. But then you realize like 99% of the people that shop at Hot Topic are the fucking worst. Like, in addition to them just like destroying the store when they come in there because they're like 14-year-olds with their friends. Like, you also just get these, like, I don't, like, just fucking weird-ass, like, anime, you know, dweebs and shit that, like, just, like, smell like their own fucking ass cheese and, like, scratch their, like, nuts in the store and have, like, greasy-haired tendrils, like, falling down their bangs and, like, they're just touching everything and they're, like, they want to have a conversation with you because they're, like, oh man, this is a Hot Topic. You work here. You're so cool.
Do you know who Bring Me the Horizon is?
Bro? Yeah, have you? Okay, that's way better. They'd be saying dumb shit now, though. They'd be like, "Have you ever heard of Falling in Reverse?"
Oh God.
And I'm like, please get. When does my fucking shift end?
You nerds ever heard of a little old band called August Burns Red?
but yeah, it's like that, or they're like. God, don't ever, like, cause you know, like, I'm so guilty of this, especially when I'd be working retail. It's like, if I'm in an uncomfortable situation, I tend to like try and like keep a conversation. Like, I would, like, one time I had this really nerdy, like, gross kid, like, in there who was like trying to have a conversation with me, but he was really awkward and weird. And I was just like, yeah, haha, yeah, haha, like, the whole time. And then like he would, there would be all these awkward silences, but like he wouldn't go away. Like he would just stay there. And so I'm like, and so like my nervous tick is just like starting up a conversation. So it's not awkward. So I'm like, oh, I see you're getting a, you know, I don't know. Like,
my thing is,
like, tea, I remember that. And that's the worst mistake, because as soon as they start talking about one of their fucking animes, it's like,
oh my God, no.
They're that just the green fog of like body odor is just like not leaving you.
Not to like, shit on anime, but yeah, like I sometimes play this game with people like unintentionally, but it's like, how many times do I have to say, wow, that's crazy before we stop talking?
Right. But it's just like, anyway, the point being, retail sucks. It's one of the worst forms of labor. It pays like shit, and you have to deal with disgusting anime weirdos who, like, I don't know, touch themselves in your store and you don't know what to do about it.
And lots of Karens, lots of your manager types.
Yeah, like I spend, you know, $1,000 a year in your store, and it's like, first of all, how, like, everything here costs like $10. And there's not that much to buy before the store's empty, because that store is literally going bankrupt as we speak. Wow. And
that's crazy.
Yeah. And so it's just like, shut the fuck up.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Entry Level Left. My name is Matt.
I'm Jared.
I'm Nathan.
And if you value the content we create here, want access to exclusive bonus episodes, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/entrylevelleft, which is one word. We also post memes, news, and current events on our Facebook page at Entry Level Left. Our link tree in the About section of our Facebook page has links to every platform that you can find us on. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Entry Level Left as well. So without further ado, tonight we've got a very special episode, sort of in the same vein of the episode that we did last time on the George Floyd police riots, but kind of expanding more on that, but also delving into more theoretical information. So tonight we're doing an episode on reform and revolution. So the first question I want to pose to the group with everything going on, what are the conceptual differences between these concepts that we've been hearing about, such as police abolition versus reform?
Obviously, right, what's been happening right now across the country has everyone, you know, kind of up in arms, rethinking the way that we have kind of allowed police and policing to exist in this country, specifically in regards to them being able to kill, arrest, etc., without warrant or without cause and without any repercussions. And so now we're kind of reaching this centerfold where we're having a discussion on whether or not to abolish the police or to reform the police. And while I think the majority of discourse is around reforming the police, we're now seeing police abolition enter into a more mainstream audience. Like, it's actually being discussed. But in terms of the difference between the two, you know, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, I know you guys have points to bring up, but essentially for the listener, reform is a means to continue with the current state of policing and the police apparatus in the United States as is, but say, banning chokeholds or requiring body cameras to be on at all times, or rerouting some of the funding to go from the police force to social services, education, and so on, versus police abolition, which basically doesn't mean literally getting rid of any form of what might be considered policing, but rethinking and reformulating policing from the ground up with a community-based approach.
So to give some specific examples of this reform versus like abolition of police, like in terms of like policing, this is the kind of stuff that you're hearing from the Democratic Party and figureheads like Biden and so on and so forth like that. And what they're attempting to do is kind of give these like these false notions of reform that realistically you really have to dig deep to really understand whether they're going to actually affect policing in the systemic way that is necessary. But for example, some things that have been talked about on that sort of liberal side would be, you know, extra body cameras. And what you have to think about, like in terms of like these type of like reformist policies, is first of all, does it reduce funding to the police? Second of all, does it challenge the notion that police increase safety? Third, does it reduce the tools, tactics, technology that police have at their disposal? And fourthly, does it reduce the scale of policing? Those are big questions that you have to ask yourself with reformist policies, like the extra body cameras, more training, even community policing, civilian review or oversight boards. Those are all, you know, in a lot of ways, increasing funding to police or police precincts or districts and departments. All those kind of things are like reformist measures. Whereas like when you get into abolition, you get things like suspending the use of paid administrative leave for cops that are under investigation, like, you know, with Derek Chauvin and those type of people. Like sometimes they get paid for literally just like murdering somebody, like withholding pensions, requiring cops to be liable for misconduct settlements. And we did an episode on police unions, if you're not familiar. But we talk about a lot of these things and why police unions are such a big impediment towards real systemic change in policing. But, you know, abolition is kind of like going and really taking that funding away from the police and diverting it elsewhere, not creating, you know, more incentives for more policing, but reducing the size of police force, prioritizing spending on the community, and withdrawing participation in police militarization programs in general.
Yeah, this is like obviously a pretty broad topic. Like someone talking about reforming the police could mean a dozen different things. And someone saying right. Abolish the police could probably also mean like a dozen different things as well.
Yep.
But I think like the spirit of the two is very different, sort of what the goal right. is overall. When you think of reform, it's like, we'll keep kind of what we have. It's sort of the few bad apples approach. Like, it mostly works, but there'll be a few things that we sort of need to take care of. And they've gotten a little out of hand recently. So, you know, instead of shooting the people in the chest, we should probably, as Joe Biden says, just like shoot them in the leg, right? I mean, it's fine. Yeah, we're shooting them. We don't need to go back and change anything about the way we escalate situations or anything about who has authority. But let's just focus on these minor tweaks so less people die. You know, let's get these numbers down so everything looks and appears to be normal. Whereas like abolition, on the other hand, is rethinking police, right? And I think we've talked about in the podcast before, I don't think any of us were like completely against the idea of having somebody doing police functions, being out there, at least being someone to help, right, you know, yeah. looking at the community, making sure that like, obviously like, you know, crazy things aren't happening all the time under everybody's noses. But at the same time, abolition takes more of a stance of like rethinking what we could do to stop crime, right? If police is right. the answer to crime, it's sort of like stepping back and thinking, do they have to be the only answer? Can we think of other things? Like, what about a strong welfare state? Like, what if we improve right. the material conditions of the people who are committing crimes, right? That's proven yeah. to be a way that stops crime. So let's get in there. Let's get them education. Let's get them healthcare. Let's get all the things that is going to, in the long run, stop them from committing crime. It's like looking at things like, you know, the drug war and saying, let's get rid of that. Because
right.
if we get rid yeah. of the drug war, we get rid of so much need for not only police, but so much correctional facilities, correctional officers, things like that, that are sort of like entrenched in the system right now. So I don't think abolition necessarily needs to be as completely radical as people think it is, but I think it still needs to be just a way of approaching police where we've completely stepped back from the question of how do we stop crime and decided there's other ways besides police, you know?
Well, yeah, stopping crime can be like a loaded thing too, because in a lot of ways, like there are incentives for policing to be done in a way that like agitates and increases crime so that they can stop it. You know what I mean? And yeah. And it's a very like complicated thing because like police have quotas and all these different things, but there have been approaches like, I think it was like, correct me if I'm wrong, if somebody knows, but maybe Minnesota, Minneapolis, where they started sending out social workers instead of police for like non-violent calls, things like that. Things like that are like what Nathan is saying is really addressing the material conditions of why there are societal ills. And like, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you should know at this point, we kind of try to come from a Marxist perspective where we're looking at these material conditions as to, you know, why they, you know, why the lack of social safety nets, why the lack of, you know, social workers, why the lack of access to, you know, economic resources and things like that create these conditions of crime. You know what I mean? And so it's not so much that like, you know, one group of people, one race of people is so like prone to crime. It's more about like the history of how these particular groups have become economically disenfranchised or disinvested from, as we've talked about in previous episodes on, you know, uneven development, where we go into gentrification, all of those things. Like, you know, even in episodes on imperialism, we kind of touch on that. But it's like, that's the important thing to look at is the material conditions of why these things are happening. But more to the point, like we've discussed things like how Biden has said this outlandish bullshit, like shoot them in the leg instead of the head. But how does like reform or even like reformist rhetoric like that actually work to maintain the status quo?
Well, I mean, I can give an example. Like, so I just pulled up Campaign Zero, which is ran by this guy. I think his name's D-Ray or DeRay. He's a total grifter. A lot of his like nonprofit work has been funded or backed by like institutions like Wells Fargo. But obviously him, his group, and many others just like this are trying to sort of seize on the opportunity of this moment to funnel like genuine radical activism and rage into just like these nonprofit circles. And so to talk about like how this reform maintains the status quo, I'm just going to go through the like 10 points. They're very brief. The 10 points that they have outlined that supposedly reduce violent policing by 70%. And the first is end broken windows policing, meaning the type of policing implemented in New York in the early 90s, I believe, which basically, you know, established quotas. And if you see even something as small as a broken window, you crack down everywhere. Number two is community oversight. Three, limit use of force. Four, independently investigate and prosecute. Five, community representation. Six, body cam / film the police. Seven, more training. Eight, end for-profit policing. Nine, demilitarization. And 10, fair police union contracts. Now, one of the ways I want to talk about this reinforcing the status quo, because a lot of those things might sound to our listener like, whoa, that all sounds good to me. However, you know, I had this thing that I just as an example that I shared on Facebook about this organization, and I was kind of railing on, you know, be careful, these nonprofits trying to like take all your radical activism and essentially, you know, profit off of it. And someone commented on it, was like, well, these 10 points are backed by the NAACP, and shouldn't we be listening to the NAACP at a time like this? And one of my friends who lives out in Madison, Wisconsin, commented with a link to like some of the policing reforms that have happened in Madison, Wisconsin, and they've already adopted 8 out of 10 of these strategies. And they're one of not only Madison, but Wisconsin in general has some of the most segregated and racist and violent police forces in the entire United States. So, you know, the reform is very much, it's very platitudinal, you know. Even we don't see police changing in a way in which, if a police officer were to break one of these 10 things, that any repercussions are really going to be tangibly followed through with.
Like, the problem with reform in the context of police is the same problem with reform in the wider context of just politics in general. Like, sure, are these things going to reduce harm? Probably.
Yeah.
You know, maybe to some extent. Some of them, maybe not. But at the same time, do they fix the core problem? You know, do they take the unethical part out of it? And usually what we tend to see is that they fix a lot of things. They don't fix everything, but they fix just enough to where people are sort of complacent. You know, they stop there and are like, yeah, we got most of what we asked for. We can just, you know, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, people stop showing up, the protests, people stop talking about it, and then it sort of just fades back into the status quo. And that's how you get this very sort of like incremental change that we've sort of seen throughout like U.S. history.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. It's like reform, it's one of those things where it's like it's a half measure. If you really look and listen to a lot of what we've been saying all throughout the show, just like capitalism, like you can reform it, like you can make it more like comfortable a la like social democracy, like with Bernie Sanders. But does that take away from the US being like an imperial force all across the world? Like, does that take away from the fact that we use like outsourced, like third world labor, you know, to produce like almost all of the commodities in this country? Does that take away from, you know, all the prison labor that we use in this country? And we'll get into that a little later when we go into like, you know, why reform may seem like appealing, but it just really masks the greater processes going on. And with regard to policing, you know, you can reform these things, like add extra body cameras, you know, take away like, or make police like accountable for specific things, regardless of their union contracts or all that. But how does that take away the systemic racism? How does that take away the disproportionate use of violence and force against Black and brown people? You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't take that away. That's endemic to the U.S. policing and police system. So in a way, like, reform is kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing in that respect. But do you guys think that toxic law enforcement culture and the systemic racism can be solved by reform?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of what we're hinting at, is that, you know, no, you know, at least in my view, I don't believe it can, because as we've discussed in prior episodes on policing and police unions, law enforcement in the United States was built on a very racist system, and it continued to be racist and extremely so, you know, even post-slavery into the Jim Crow South and all of these sorts of things, and not only in the South, but in the North as well. And so they've never had a systemic rectification of that. And what it's led to is that, you know, maybe even though we live in what has been deemed by the neoliberal world order as a post-racial society, you know, the cops aren't out here necessarily, well, on camera at least, you know, saying racial slurs and all that, and, you know, all that sort of stuff like they used to in prior years, or certainly not openly. The reality is that disproportionately, they're still targeting the same communities that they were designed to repress from the beginning, disproportionately so than others. They reinforce the class hierarchy within the United States, and there isn't a way, unless they are met with an abolitionary framework, for that, in my view, to be solved. Because unless they're presented with that sort of abolitionist framework, and we use that seriously and look at new and entirely new ways to rethink and restructure to a community-based sort of quote-unquote policing, even though maybe it might have a different terminology, we can't actually just reform our way out of these extremely repressive dynamics that policing in the United States continues to this day to reinforce.
Yeah, it's embedded. It's baked into the cake. You know what I mean? And all of those things are really important. But I think at the root of it is, like we've always talked about, you know, we see the greatest response to these type of protests and riots specifically when property is damaged. Now, I'm sure listeners can kind of guess at why that is, but realistically, you have to make the jump to say, police aren't necessarily here to protect you and yours, but more so to protect the property of the rich, to maintain order, to, you know, establish the status quo, to enforce the status quo. And then you have the liberal corporate media saying things like, I don't think systemic racism is a problem. I think blah, blah, blah. 99% of the law enforcement officers are great Americans, for example. But there's a few bad apples, quote unquote. But like, if you look at, like, I think it was like a week ago, there was a, something we posted on the Facebook page, and it was like, since the murder of George Floyd, there has been 120 and probably rising police murders since then. So to say that it's just a few bad apples, I think is really misses the mark here. One officer to be able to, like, with like no discretion, stand on a man's neck for 9 minutes and feel no empathy and no sympathy, like, that is, like, Jared, we've talked about this personally, but it's like, that is the result of, like, extreme prejudice. You know what I mean? Like, that is the result of a culture of extreme prejudice that doesn't just, you know, start with an individual and end with an individual. And this is the problem that we've always talked about with neoliberalism. It gets people to think in this atomized, individualized sense when there's no such thing as, it, like, an individual society. Like, thing like culture, influence, confirmation bias, all of those things influence the police, and their job, the way they see it, they think of themselves as heroes. They think of themselves as community defenders, and it really creates this often toxically masculine or toxically misogynist culture where they reinforce this stuff. And there have been, you know, news articles come out, like, even as far back as, like, when the ICE detention stuff started to ramp up back in, what was it, like, 2016, 17, maybe? You're seeing news come out of, like secret police chats where they're talking, like, about, like, immigrants as if they're, like, less than human. And even now, during these protests, the police, you know, in secret chats talking about protesters as if they were just less than human. And this is like a real systemic problem. There's no end ifs or buts about it. Like, the corporate liberal media does not have its fingers on the pulse of what's going on. They're trying to obfuscate and hide all of these things, but it's only going to bubble back up because, like we said, it's all baked into the cake.
You start off asking us if reform could fix law enforcement culture and systemic racism. And I think the first case study sort of that comes to mind for me on this is really the issue of police body cameras. I think, 10 years ago, that was probably the most radical thing that we could think of. Yeah. Putting a body camera on everybody, you know, like, oh, it's going to cost so much money. You know, what are the privacy concerns? There was so much pushback, and there still is. Like, cities like Tampa are still throwing their hands in the air being like, well, I don't know if we can really pull this off. Like, I don't know, dragging their feet. You know, they've recommitted to it, I think, recently, but at the same time, you know, we can see these examples of people sort of fighting against body cameras in general. And I think last year, Vox had posted an article that had gone over a previous kind of like a meta-analysis of all the research on police body cams. And what they found is that cities that had police body cams had really no significant difference between cities that didn't when it comes to officer behavior or the citizen opinion of police. So even ideas that might seem like a radical reform, things that were like, this will change everything, don't necessarily actually change anything once they're put into place. You know, there needs to be a wider systemic approach to these types of issues.
There's also like negligence too. Like, that's a factor you've got to think about too, is like, you know, even if these cops have body cams, like, how many stories have y'all heard where the cop literally turns the body cam off?
Right? Yeah,
or exactly. Different things where, like, they forcibly are negligent in the situation, and then the police union steps in and covers their asses.
Yeah.
Like that's what the big discussion is about qualified immunity going on in the liberal circles. But realistically, like, there's such a like incredible power structure that exists between law enforcement on the ground and the police unions that back them up, and create sort of like a a system of negligence for the police themselves. So it's one of those things that, like, if you consider yourself a reformist while you're listening to this episode, consider the fact that there's always going to be individual negligence, but individual negligence can easily turn into systemic problems when you factor in all the power structures involved. With that said, in the American context, why do we stress that class and race are inseparable with regards to, you know, social uprisings and social revolutions like we're seeing with these protests?
I mean, just look at the way that they're even talking about right now with, like, obviously, number one, you have a horrific killing of George Floyd. Clearly the reaction of the police and doing that, know that there's not going to be any consequences. Otherwise, how do you sit with your neck for 9 minutes on another man while the other police officers stand around with their pockets? There's been an uprising in response to this. You know, if black people in this country especially are sick and tired of police disproportionately attacking them and their communities. And while they're protesting this, the first concern of the media, of liberals, of white America is, you know, but what about the looting? What about the property destruction? So there's already in this right here, this sort of class dynamic where the first primary concern is that of private property and private enterprise. In the other regards, you know, why class and race are inseparable with regards to, you know, social relations, social revolutions, is that race becomes a means of forcing someone into a permanent underclass within society by othering them with the intent to propose one section of the working class versus another section of the working class and reinforcing it so that state power, property owners, etc., are sort of all defended by members of the sort of normal average laboring class, particularly the white laboring class, or at least that's how it has been historically.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And so I kind of wrote a little research paper on this for one of my undergrad classes that I just got through. But basically, it was sort of a Marxist analysis of the Civil War. And when I was researching it, it's pretty clear and incredibly clear how dependent this whole country, all of our infrastructure, all of our wealth was dependent on the labor of slavery. And obviously, that seems like a no-brainer to say. But the Civil War was literally fought over economics. You know what I mean? And this problem has never really gone away. I think it was like Ulysses S. Grant was trying to give out land per Lincoln when the war ended, and they gave ex-slaves land, and then that decision was reversed when Lincoln was assassinated and they claimed all that stuff back. And then after that, they had like Jim Crow laws and all the, you know, redlining, all type of like white flight and like the urban core, hollowing out of the urban core. All of that stuff is like comes from the history of this country all the way back from the Civil War, Reconstruction, and so on. So, you know, if you consider yourself a Marxist or you're trying to understand Marxism, you really have to look at the American context from that angle. Like, we come from a deeply divided history, a deeply economically divided history, where white supremacy has always sought to disenfranchise black people for fear of them rising up and you know, disenfranchising the white people like they did to them. So it's one of these things where, you know, class and race in the American context is really inseparable, because for so much of our history, you know, your standing in society, your citizenship, your rights, all dependent on the color of your skin. So in America specifically, race and class are inseparable. And liberals really need to understand that, you know, more so than a race issue, it's fundamentally tied to class, what is going on. And it goes beyond just, you know, an isolated killing or, you know, these lynchings are all a product of white supremacy, but it goes deeper than that, because capitalism itself in this country is founded upon a basis of white supremacy.
Yeah, I'd want to be careful in saying that while class and race are inseparable, they're not exactly the same thing. Like, we have to take a pretty intersectional approach to these types of things. I don't think that a poor white person goes through the same thing that a black person does. Those aren't necessarily the same exact thing.
Definitely not.
You know? So that's not what we're saying. That would be pretty much exactly sort of like the caricature of like a class reductionist. Somebody who thinks that all these problems with race or gender or things like that all just come down to just the economics of the situation and nothing else. It's just class. They can only be oppressed solely because they're a different class. And I think, as we talked a little bit earlier this week between all of us, I think we kind of agreed that there has to be something deeper than that. There is probably something that is not economic in all likelihood that causes people to want to other each other. You know, there has to be some sort of natural sort of inclination to that type of thing.
It's fear and protectionism of the like a tribal group or something like that. Yeah. But yeah, it is essentially like an othering. You know, there's an economic disenfranchisement, but you know, the othering had to have come first. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why class and race are distinct concepts, but they've been tied together because of the history of the U.S.
And
is what I meant to say.
And kind of where I'm getting at as well was, the reason that they're inseparable, in my opinion, is that the solutions to them are so similar in so many different ways, right? If you want to empower black people, it's just like empowering the lower classes, you know? When it comes to healthcare, give them healthcare. When it comes to things like education, give them educations. A lot of the things that we would do to liberate black or any other minority culture really in America are really the same things we would do to liberate the lower class. I mean, again, that's not saying that they're the exact same thing, but that's saying that they're so tied together in the way that when we fix one, we're doing so much to fix the other as well. Not necessarily all of it, but at least a huge portion of it.
So we want to get deeper into like the theoretical basis as far as the left goes for reform versus revolution. Now that we've kind of discussed this, you know, in the vein of police abolition or reform, and we want to take that concept that we're trying to, you know, elucidate for people that reform is not necessarily all it's cracked up to be, and transition into an understanding of where this debate comes from. So with that in mind, you know, if you've been on the left for a while or you find yourself pretty versed, you may already understand this or know of this, but we'll start with Rosa Luxemburg and Edward Bernstein and their conceptions of revolution and reform. So what are the differences mainly between Rosa's perspective and Bernstein's perspective?
Well, Matt, I know you have probably a much more, you know, thorough, succinct answer on this, but I just want to, before you get into that, you know, really nail home for the listener that essentially where this concept, this idea of reform or revolution comes from was from a book, essay, depending on what pamphlet, whatever you want to call it, that was written by Rosa Luxemburg in response to a more reformist position that was put forth by Bernstein. Her calling for a more revolutionary approach to implementing the socialist project versus the, you know, kind of get into the current established government and try and reform your way to socialism or legislate your way to socialism within the framework of the powers that be. And, you know, one of the quotes that I want to pull out from Reform or Revolution by Luxemburg is she states that every legal constitution is the product of a revolution. In the history of classes, revolution is the act of political creation, while legislation is the political expression of the life of a society that has already come into being. So the revolutionary argument or the revolutionary outlook is that if you're trying to build a new society, you have to have a revolution to implement it, because the contract or the constitution of the current society of which you're in already exists, and it's not going to reform itself into an entirely new social order.
So, yeah, just, you know, piggybacking on that, I would say Luxemburg argued that that like trade unions, reformist political parties, and the expansion of social democracy, you know, while important to the working class's development and their class consciousness, it couldn't create like a socialist society, as Bernstein argued, among others. And instead, she argued from a historical materialist perspective, as we do here on the entry-level left, that capitalism is economically unsustainable and will eventually collapse, and that a revolution is necessary to transform capitalism into socialism, kind of like you said.
Okay. I think overall, you know, if we were to really like put this into perspective, just as a final point on this for the listener, Bernstein would be like your modern day social democratic kind of, maybe not modern day in terms of his politics, but similar to your kind of like, let's say, for the sake of just articulating this point, like a Bernie Sanders versus Rosa Luxemburg would be like a, I don't know, someone from a revolutionary socialist party, someone who's unwilling to run as a Democrat. They want to just completely upend the society that exists today.
So what are our individual opinions on reform or revolution? And what are the downsides to each?
Yeah, I think it can be a complicated question, because I think there are times where you look at something that is considered reform and you want it and you should probably have it. There's like a right. amount of harm reduction that we're always going to be attracted to. You know, just recently, for example, the Supreme Court, you know, they made a small step towards more equality for LGBTQIA community, you know, and that's amazing. Like, that's something that we should celebrate. But at the same time, it's really difficult, because it doesn't get us any closer to fixing sort of the root of the problem, as we've sort of been alluding to this whole time. And so that's where concern is because it's always like, what will be the jumping off point? You know, where are we going to say like reforms are not enough? You know, how long are we going to keep up this appeasement game? How long are we going to keep fighting? You know, there's people literally out there right now in the George Floyd protest dying, and they're probably dying just to get some sort of moderate reform. And it's kind of, you know, it can be a little bit daunting. Like, even when we have something that's successful, like with what the Supreme Court did, it can be a little daunting knowing how many people are putting themselves in danger or sacrificing their entire lives just to get these really just minuscule changes, you know?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me, in my opinion, on reform or revolution is, like, from what I've seen with reform and all these things, like, you mentioned, you know, LGBTQIA rights. Trump recently rolled back Obama-era transgender healthcare protections, for example. So it's like, with reform, you're always subject to having your rights and your privileges rolled back by this insane two-party duopoly that we have. Whereas with a revolution, you know, these things become part of the new order, and that you establish a new order with new control so that these things can't be rolled back. And that's like my biggest, you know, jumping point for being pro-revolution rather than reform. And then obviously the downsides to revolution is the fact that it's bloody and violent, and it's a massacre, you know, often, and especially so like would be the case here in America, because the left really has no institutional power. But that is a big downside, you know, and I think that's why liberals are more likely to, you know, go towards these little reformist one step forward, two step back type of solutions, because they really are the path of least resistance. And, you know, we were talking about it today, and Jared said it's like, oftentimes liberals and their complacency like enables the system to slide back and reverse all these rights and reforms that have been won. So that is another big, big downside to like reform, in my opinion.
I guess I have like a really nuanced take on this, and, you know, hopefully I don't talk for too long about it, but on one hand, I think that the left needs a new concept of what a revolution is, you know, as I think it's often talked about in, like, you know, revolutionary Marxist circles, is like, it's this inherently insurrectionary, violent, blah, blah, whatever. And I don't know that that's necessarily always the case. Historically speaking, I think there have been revolutions and upendings of society and total changing and reformulating and recontracting of societies that weren't insurrectionary or violent. The degree to which that happens, you know, like how many were successful versus weren't successful, I don't know, versus those that were insurrectionary. But I think the left needs to kind of come up with a new way to not only think about revolution, but when it's opportune and when society at large is ready for that and what it takes to get there. Second of all, one thing I particularly despise about this notion of revolution is that of how often it is fetishized on the left by people who like haven't ever even like fucking, you know, shot a gun or been in a violent scenario. And it's fetishized in a way that it's like it doesn't understand the fact of how violent and disgusting and how often a revolutionary act fails. They fail far more times than they are successful. The problem is, historically, you only learn about the ones that have won and have been successful, you know? And I think that most of the leftists I've seen that like fetishize it are like too chicken shit to even understand the repercussions of what a revolution even is, yet alone engage with one. And also, this idea that a revolution, if it should happen or spring up, will lead to some sort of socialist action or intervention is just, you know, it's kind of nonsense, in the, at least in the current moment, because, I mean, take a perfectly good example of a modern revolution against an oppressive state apparatus, the civil war in Syria. I don't know of any Marxists and socialists currently waging a struggle in that environment, you know, and it's still going on, and it's decimated an entire country. In addition to that, you know, it's hard for me to even conceptualize this idea of revolution, you know, happening or being on the horizon when the left doesn't even have an actually existing workers' party advocating for labor and workers' rights and that sort of thing in a way that is gaining traction and would ultimately have to lead something like that. And so for me, I feel that the best thing that can be done now is the left needs to coalesce around a workers' party. We need to get our shit together in this department. We may have to take the L on some issues. We may not be as fucking sectarian as we want, you know, not me personally, but other groups. And need to at least use the avenues of existing political infrastructure. That could even mean running elections in the current system and running candidates, whether they be outside of the Democratic Party or kicking shit within it, I don't know, in order to gain mass class consciousness, in order for people to understand who is with them and who is against them on a mass scale. Because currently, that's not even remotely the case. Bernie did a great job, I think, at radicalizing a lot of new people. I think these protests are doing a great job at radicalizing some new people into the left fold. But this idea of reform versus revolution, history is too unstable, you know, for me to really say that this one act is going to lead to the result that we want as socialists. I know that's kind of not a really clear answer, but I have to just kind of give that nuanced approach so our listeners at least have something to think about in regards to this debate.
Wow.
Sure.
Wow, that's crazy, dude.
Wow, that's crazy.
I want to like 100% agree with so many things that you're saying, Jared. You know, I think a lot of people think of revolution, they're thinking specifically of like, I don't know, like Wolverines and like overthrowing some sort of like massive power. But I don't think revolution necessarily means violence, you know? A lot of times that's part of it. But, like, we talk a lot about historical periods as revolutions, like the Industrial Revolution, you know? It's reworking the way that we think about something. And in this new revolution, that really needs to be mass class consciousness, like you said, right? And we've seen this in the past. Like, when Martin Luther said, here's 95 things I fucking hate about this goddamn church, you know? Posted it on their goddamn wall. He was essentially changing the way that we were going to think about religion for the rest of time. You know, he started a whole new strain of thought, you know, that still isn't done, which is pretty crazy to think about. You know, if you take a moment and think about how many things have come sort of forth because of that strain of thought. And that's what we need to do with class consciousness, you know, and that's the core of the revolution. Will it be violence for it? Yeah, probably. Has the revolution maybe started? Have we seen some of the roots? I hope, but I'm not 100% sure, you know? And the other thing that you said too, is it often leads to failure. And I think that's the speaking more to the sort of the violent aspects of it, or the sudden aspects of a sort of the mass revolution that I'm talking about, is that it can be a death sentence. You know, if you read any biographies about Lenin, I mean, he got on that train absolutely thinking he was going to get there and probably just immediately be executed. Like, he had no idea what was going to happen when he got to Russia. There was just no amount of confidence that he had that he would ever end up in power like he did. And I'm not saying, like, this isn't a moral call about whether it was the right or wrong thing to do. But at the same time, I think he, you know, it was either him or it might have been like Huey Newton or something later on that had said that a revolutionary's first lesson is to know that he is doomed, or something along the lines of that. And I think that's sort of really pertinent about this, is that this is for the long haul. It's not going to be as easy as turning the page. And I guess last two, you know, in my personal opinion, like you said, using existing routes is really the only way that we can start this process, at least. You know, in my opinion, it would seem at least most ethical that we push until there's resistance. And if the resistance at that point is too much, that's when we start to move to more extreme measures. If we just jump to extreme measures, it feels like we might be doing everybody a disservice. You know what I mean? If we're stepping outside of democracy to do certain actions, it can be sort of problematic, and it can sort of destroy the moment. You know, it can sort of create a bad taste in people's mouth about our movement, you know, and you can see sort of how that even organically was something that was a problem in like the early Soviet Union and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Excited to get to that at some point.
one day.
So if you're listening to this, like, we do intend to at some point get to the USSR and a lot of these different like specific historical contexts and really kind of delve into them. But yeah, with that in mind, do y'all think that we're witnessing a revolutionary moment currently with like the Chaz and things like COVID interfering with the economy and creating undue economic stress on everything? Like, do you think that we're in a revolutionary moment?
I think that this is the most revolutionary moment I've seen in my lifetime. You know, I'm not very old, you know, so I think that there have been similar revolutionary times within, or quote, revolutionary potential for revolution times throughout U.S. history that haven't necessarily led to revolutions, but did lead to massive changes within society. We'll say that. But I don't think we're witnessing a revolutionary moment personally right now. Again, going back to my remarks in the previous question in regard to class consciousness, we've all been at these rallies. While I have definitely seen some radicalism, I don't think it's quite there yet in tying itself to a more, you know, left strategy of, say, we're not going to fucking vote for these pieces of shit. We're going to advocate something more radical. We're going to organize around a economic and social program, you know, that is to the left of just, say, the nonprofit industrial complex or the Democratic Party. But I think, too, if this is a, quote, revolutionary moment, I think this is more of our 1905, not our 1917.
Yeah.
And that the seeds may be being laid, but this isn't the time yet. And I think, too, people need to keep in mind, again, I brought it up on the last question, just because a revolution happens doesn't mean it's a socialist one. There's been plenty of revolutions that have happened in the 20th century when the Soviet Union existed as a state, and, you know, potentially even funding revolutions that were not inherently socialist, you know, many of which liberating the third world in Africa and many, many countries in Africa. You know, that didn't end up leading socialist ventures. They were more sort of national liberation ventures. Something like that could happen here too. You know,
yeah,
we don't know. until shit's happening. But at least for me personally, I don't believe we're witnessing a revolution at the time, but we're certainly witnessing some revolutionary potential. We'll say that.
Yeah.
Fucking beautifully said. I don't even know what to add to that.
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. So
absolutely.
Just buckle up. But yeah, with that said, thanks for listening to the Entry Level Left, and we hope you tune in next time.